The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So we've just celebrated the festival of Samantabhadra, who is referred to in our tradition as the Bodhisattva of active love. Samantabhadra, the word, is usually translated as universal goodness, but I recently stumbled upon it translated as universal kindness, which I thought was an interesting shift in its meaning. And I'd have to say that I've never been quite clear about what's meant by active love in this case, so I don't think I can speak authoritatively on it. But I think it must have something to do with putting our love into action by doing something for someone. Also in our tradition, we commonly speak of our meditation and training as transforming greed, hatred, and delusion, the three poisons, into compassion, love, and wisdom. So in this case, transformed hatred in all its manifestations becomes love in all its manifestations. And this triad, compassion, love, and wisdom, is represented by three bodhisattvas, Avalokiteshvara, or Kanzan, or Guanyin, as you may know her, representing compassion, Samantabhadra representing love, and Manjushri representing wisdom. So I thought today I'd say a few words about love, which is so central to our lives as human beings, really. And so I thought it might be interesting to explore the part it plays in our Buddhist practice, or at least begin to explore it, because there's so much more that could be said than what I'm going to say. Time to say. Love is a word that we hear a lot in Christianity, but interestingly enough, it's not all that common in Buddhism, at least in the old days. In the Pali Nikayas, the earliest written down teachings of the Buddha, this is the Majjhima Nikaya. You can see it's a big fat book. It's got 1,150 pages of scripture in it, writings of the Buddha's teachings. And if you look in the index, the word love isn't even there. And that is true of all the Nikayas. I took a quick look through them. The word lust is there, but not the word love. And is that, well, anyway, I won't comment on that. And that's also true of Buddhist dictionaries and encyclopedias, which I found quite interesting. But on the other hand, modern Western Buddhist teachers use the word quite a bit. So I find that kind of interesting. Maybe that's a contribution that Western Buddhism will make to Buddhism, is bringing that word into prominence or to our attention. One ancient Zen master said, Zen has so much respect for human love that it rarely mentions it. And I thought that was an interesting thought, because perhaps love is hidden in plain sight in our practice, that it's embedded in our meditation practice, our keeping of the precepts, our practices, our daily life practices of generosity and kindness, things like that. So, what I'm trying to suggest is that I think it's there. It's just that we haven't called it that. We haven't called it love. Now, since I was about 15 years old, I've had this aspiration that I was verbally conscious of, to love all beings, to love all beings equally, without attachment and without conditions. And I'm not sure I should be admitting this in public because it takes a lot of hubris to have an aspiration like that, right? And also, it's very embarrassing how little in all the years since I've been 15, which is quite many, how little I've manifested that aspiration. But I keep trying. And in the end, you know, I think it was Buddhism that I chose as the vehicle to manifest it. So we'll see how that works out. Now, I'd like to look at the words in that aspiration for the moment, beginning with equally. Love all beings equally means not to prefer one's spouse or partner or children or parents or friends over strangers, or even those one despises or has difficulty with. Tall order, yeah? Without attachment means that we can let go of any being, including all those I just mentioned, so that they can be free to be their best selves, without owing us anything, without fulfilling our expectations, including the expectation that they love us. Now, I want to emphasize that non-attachment does not mean lacking in human emotion. It means not clinging to any one view of a being. It's not clinging to any one view of a being. And it's important to remember that non-attachment and connection do not stand against each other. So we can practice non-attachments in our loving relationships without violating any sense of connection or wiping out any sense of connection. Without conditions means that no matter what a person does and no matter what circumstances they put us in, we still love them. Even though their choices may sometimes make life very hard for us, make us miserable, we still continue to love them. Some of us have probably experienced this in our lives. Now, all of those things I think are incredibly hard to do. I think they're possible. Maybe folks like Gandhi and the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu or, you know, some other highly evolved spiritual beings are able to manifest this kind of love. I do think it's possible. I don't think that the difficulty of it means, or that any of it means, that we need to give up human relationship, particularly those that are most important to us, spousal relationships, partners, children, you know, these relationships that are really crucial in our lives. What I think it means instead is that those relationships are fundamentally important because they become the locus for practicing this kind of love. They become the place, the circumstances in which we can really practice this love, which is equal, unattached, and without conditions. And I would also assert that love that is not equal and without attachment and without conditions is not true love, with a capital T and a capital L. So that's all a tall order. But I do think it's possible. And it puts me in mind of a rock song that Reverend Master Mahon quoted in a talk she gave. Was your talk on love? I forget. Anyway. Love the one you're with. If you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. Okay? Universal. You can just forget about who you're with and just love, right? So now I want to go back to that word love and inquire a little bit into what it might mean. And what I would say about it, I guess I would just assert point blank that meditation is love, or love is meditation. And I want to read you a story, a koan story from way back when, the 9th century actually, to attempt to illustrate what I mean. After some period of practice with Yunnan, just before parting to visit other teachers, Dongshan asked Yunnan. So Yunnan's the teacher and Dongshan's his student. Later on, if I am asked to describe your reality or your teaching, how should I respond? After some pause, Yunnan said, just this is it. Just this is it. Dongshan departed without further comment. Later, while wading across a stream, he looked down, saw his reflection, and awakened to the meaning of the previous exchange. He then wrote the following verse. Just don't seek from others, or you'll be far estranged from self. I now go on alone. Everywhere I meet it. It now is me. I now am not it. One must understand in this way to merge with suchness, or to merge with just this. Suchness is a synonym for just this. So I'll read that verse again. Just don't seek from others, or you'll be far estranged from self. I now go on alone. Everywhere I meet it. It now is me. I now am not it. Sorry, I never get through a Dharma talk without crying. I don't know what it is. So I want to focus on two phrases from this story. And the first one is just this is it, which is Yunnan's summation of all the teaching he's given to Dongshan. It's more than that. It's his understanding of what the Dharma is and what his practice of the Dharma is and his being within the Dharma. Just this is it is about presence. The greatest gift you can give to someone you love is to be present with them. The greatest gift you can give to someone you love is to be present with them. Giving this gift to our karma when it arises cleanses it. So if you want to know how to cleanse karma, there's the answer. The simple answer. In our meditation practice, we stay right with whatever is there, no matter what it is, without trying to change it or fix it or make it what we want. We just stay right there with it. This is the intimacy of being right with actually what is. Whether it's a thought, an emotion, a memory, another person, an event, anything, this is our daily practice all day long. And this is our meditation practice. It's a listening that rejects nothing, resists nothing, accepts all. Just this is it. There's no need for anything more or anything else. Okay? Now the second phrase I want to focus on is, it now is me, I now am not it. So it turns out that Dongshan is Tozan Ryokai. And Tozan Ryokai, for those of you who know our ancestral line, is one of the names that appears there. And he wrote the most excellent mirror samadhi. And these lines, it now is me, I now am not it, appear in the most excellent mirror samadhi, translated as, you are not him, he is all of you. And Reverend Master Jiu capitalized him and he to signify that this is a reference to the unborn, to eternal Buddha nature. So when Dongshan or Tozan Ryokai says, it now is me, the it is a capital T, not just because it's at the beginning of the sentence, because he's referring to the great understanding, to the truth, to the cosmic Buddha, to the eternal, whatever word you choose to name it with. It now is me. I now am not it. Or I am him or her, but I am not. I mean, it is all of me, but I am not the whole of it, in effect. Am I getting that across? So this is even closer than being present. Okay? One Zen master expressed this as, if I can turn my page, the entire universe is your I. The entire universe is your complete body. The entire universe, in the entire universe, excuse me, there is no one who is not your own self. So the entire universe is your I. The entire universe is your complete body. In the entire universe, there is no one who is not your own self. We are so close to each other that we are inside each other. All things interpermeate each other. Carl Sagan put it, we're all made of stardust. One of my favorites. When we let go of the self, of attachment to self, of selfishness, wanting things our own way, our experience of our deep and vast interconnection with all beings becomes increasingly apparent to us. But this is dependent on letting go of self. And as we do let go of self, this interconnection becomes increasingly apparent to us. True love is the true seeing of our oneness and our non-separateness. We are not separate. And it's astounding to me how much it can feel like we are, but we aren't. And as we train, each little bit of training that we do whittles away at that sense of separation, and the connection appears. I think of it as like one fire joining another. Okay, so that's a little bit about how I'm thinking about what love is. And now I'd like to sort of put forth a mandala of the practice of love. And this is something I've made up, and it's a rough attempt. So I would encourage you to experiment with your own permutations of it. At the center, in a kind of yin-yang relationship, I would put presence and kindness or caring. So those two are in the center together, kindness and presence. And then I would put a circle around that that consists of the four wisdoms and the four Brahma-viharas or immeasurable minds. And I'll tell you what those are. The four wisdoms come from, many of you will be familiar with them, they come from Dogen Shushogi, charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy. Charity, I'll just lay out for you how Dogen talks about them. Charity is making offerings, though we get nothing in return. Tenderness, and I think this is a really interesting one, that he includes tenderness in these four, of all the things he could have picked. Tenderness, to behold all beings with the eye of compassion and to speak kindly to them. You know, if I could learn just that one, that would be pretty good. Benevolence, to create wise ways of helping others. And sympathy, to identify oneself with that which is not oneself. Okay? That obviously supports the interconnection, doesn't it? Now, the four Brahma-viharas are immeasurable minds, and they're one of the reasons they're called as immeasurable is because they're limitless. You can't run out of them. And I think that's kind of encouraging. No matter how much you give away, there's still plenty there. The first one is loving kindness, understanding someone deeply, which enables us to love them unconditionally without expecting anything in return. So there again, there's that not expecting anything in return. Compassion is the second Brahma-vihara. It's the intention and capacity to relieve and transform suffering and to lighten sorrows. One modern-day teacher calls compassion the refinement of love that opens to suffering, the refinement of loving-kindness that opens to suffering. I find that helpful for distinguishing compassion from loving-kindness. Sympathetic joy is the ability to rejoice in somebody else's joy, you know, somebody else's good fortune, somebody else's happiness, or a quality of mind that rejoices for self and other, in a way that brings peace and contentment to both, or happiness to both, or joy to both. Equanimity is non-attachment, non-discrimination, even-mindedness, letting go. Again, if your love has attachment, discrimination, prejudice, or clinging in it, it's not true love. So that's a very quick portrayal of these aspects of this second circle of the mandala. They're practices. They're not something we think about. They're things we do. And by implementing these practices, we support this aspiration to love equally, unconditionally, and without attachment, should you have such an aspiration. And the thing that's important to remember about them is that they are applied universally. That is, to all beings. Nobody's left out. Nothing's left out. Not just to the ones we like. And as I said, that's a very brief account, and I'm going to go on from there. I'm giving you very little tastes, and think of them as jewels in the mandala that you can explore at a later date if you wish to. So that's the center circle, and around that circle is a third circle, which I think of as the qualities of heart and mind that we cultivate in our practice, which support the eight practices I just listed. And they begin with open-heartedness and open-mindedness. So if we can just keep before our eyes the sense of open-heartedness, that quality supports the other qualities that I have put in this outer circle. Qualities like spaciousness, unboundedness, all-inclusiveness, vastness. So there's something very big about this. It can hold everything within itself with ease. It's not so hard from that point of view. There's enough room for everything. You know, it's that old saying, if you want to tame your bull, give it a big pasture. It's non-resistant. It's non-rejecting. It's a heart mind which is allowing and accepting and selfless. Okay, so that's the outer circle. I think of this outer circle as the circle of wisdom, and the inner circle with the eight practices as the circle of compassion. Compassion as the inner circle generates wisdom, the outer circle. And wisdom, which is presence in that innermost circle, that yin-yang circle, I think of presence as being the aspect of wisdom. And compassion, which is kindness in that innermost central circle, are the two pillars of Zen, right? The two pillars, pillars on which all our training rests. And they arise simultaneously as we train. So just do your training, compassion and wisdom grow, right? So as we orient ourselves towards the aspects of the mandala or the jewels of the mandala, love flourishes both within and is expressed without. So that's all we have to do. So then imagine the whole of this mandala surrounded by or held by and surrounded, you know, like with a sphere, not a two-dimensional circle, held by the precepts, held within the precepts, which are the spiritual guides of our mind and heart. Now, the precepts, I've recently begun, and I don't know why it took me so long, to think of the precepts as expressions of our interconnectedness, of our care for each other. And, you know, it's kind of obvious in the end, isn't it? You know, don't kill. Well, take care of each other. You know, support life. Don't do the things that cause harm to others and that cause fear to arise so that we become fearful of each other and of living. So the precepts are an expression of this interconnectedness, and I think that this view of them can go a long way towards, for those of you like myself, who have difficulty shaking the thou shalt not commandment aspect of the precepts, which can sometimes cause me to not want to have to pay attention to them. But if I think of them as interconnectedness and I think of them as surrounding and supporting this mandala of love, then I find them much more friendly and accessible and something I can really turn to and use. Now, I want to emphasize that I think that in order to actually live and express this kind of love that we're talking about today, it's very important to begin by retraining our thoughts. And there are two reasons for that, and one is that speech and actions follow thoughts. So if we begin with the thoughts, we create a kind of domino effect with our speech and actions, and they will, if we can retrain our habits of thought, speech and action will follow in a positive direction. The other thing is that this is how we break habit patterns, actually, that our thoughts create grooves, in a sense, in our brain, and we have to actively retrain those thoughts in order to fill in the groove that's not helping and create the groove that does help, or fill in the groove that causes suffering and create the groove that brings an end to suffering. And there are practices for this, and I mentioned four of them, eight of them, the four wisdoms and the four Brahma Viharas. And in traditional Buddhism, there are practices that go along with the four Brahma Viharas, the four immeasurable minds, that are standard. And if you want to know more about them, you know, there's not time to talk about them today, but this is an excellent book to read. It's Sharon Salzberg's Loving Kindness, The Revolutionary Art of Happiness. And she focuses on cultivating loving kindness, but she also includes compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So I would point you in that direction if you're interested in that kind of practice. But what I mention this because I have found it incredibly helpful to me. The way that I find I can use a practice like this in our tradition is when a defiling passion arises. The slightest thought of or feeling of irritation, you know, ill will, little ill wills, doesn't have to be big. Depression or despair, you know, the critical mind, greed, lust, these things that don't help, that do cause suffering if we act from them inappropriately. The moment something like that arises in my mind, I replace it with a thought of loving kindness. And this can be really powerful when you're in front of somebody who's making you nuts, you know, and you just want to deck them, pardon my language. and you know, right there in that moment with that person, may you be well and happy. May you be free from suffering. May no harm come to you. May you be at peace. Something simple like this. You can find a way to say it that works for you, that you can relate to. Just say, may you be well and happy. Changes everything. And it goes a long way to restructuring, but to changing those habits, those habit patterns. You know, if you get angry and you act angrily, you reinforce that habit. But if you get angry and you think to yourself, may you be well and happy, you cut the habit. And I think this kind of moment by moment, minuscule bits of training with this make a huge difference. So if you want a place to begin, that's a suggestion. I also would like to suggest that it's way easier to love when you're happy or when you're joyful. You know, the magnanimity of that kind of feeling, the hugeness of it, that kind of mind, it's way easier to be generous and offer love and support to another human being than when we're upset, uptight, and constrained. And I do believe that it's possible to cultivate happiness and joy. I don't think we have to kind of sit around waiting for them to come to us. I think it's easy to make a mistake here and pursue happiness in the worldly sense, which we all know just creates suffering. But I think we can cultivate happiness and joy by simply turning towards them, and that's all it takes. In a way, it's just to remember them. Remember that they exist. Consider a blade of grass. One blade of grass. It's an incredible miracle. I recently read a book about how the human body works. It's unbelievable. And look, there's millions of these unbelievable human bodies running all over the planet, you know. There are so many opportunities to look to something and see the wonder in it, see the miracle in it, to have gratitude for it, for all that it gives us, for all it gives to other things. Forget about us, you know. So this simply turning towards it, turn towards joy, turn towards happiness, can cultivate them so that they arise in our experience more often. And this creates a kind of largesse or boundlessness of mind and heart, which I think is, well, it's a kind of generosity, which is the basis for love, and out of which the kind of love we're talking about today can spring quite naturally and maybe more readily and easily than we thought at the beginning. And it's important to forget that this love is not limited. There's not a limited supply. It pours forth freely. It's unbounded. It's always accessible to us. So while loving equally and without attachment and without conditions can seem to be too different, too difficult, an aspiration to attempt, I think that there are ways that we can approach it. And I think it's also important to remember that the goal is not the point. It's not a matter of getting there. It's a matter of just doing it bit by bit. The point is the practice. And each moment of our lives that we put this into practice, that's a moment of being within this love. And if we hold this vision of loving equally without attachments and without conditions, if we hold this before us as we go our way, it begins to manifest itself. To me, that's a pretty good way to spend a life. Thank you.